consequences of this mentality that has been introduced and supported with all this money and weapons and political rhetoric over the years? We're seeing the consequences of that play out.
Kumba, you spoke earlier about the different countries that are in the region, in the Sahel region, because of the resources in the region. So if you could explain what those resources are, energy reserves, gold, etc., and also the impact of the climate crisis in the Sahel region, which is reportedly heating at 1.5 times the rate of the global average.
Yes, you know, if we start with Niger, it is uranium. The issue is uranium. Why is everybody so interested in a small country that is, you know, desertic? It's not because there is, you know, there is love there. The issue and is always about resources, and it always has been for the whole African continent, and it's not something new. You take it back all the way, you know, from slavery to colonization to this day. Countries of the Western, you know, hemisphere, whether it's Europe, U.S., Canada, people, these countries have come to Africa for the resources. And today, the main resources that people are looking at are energetic resources, it's mineral resources, of course, for arms, for technology, and for energy. But what I really want to convey is that it is about time that we look at the lives of people, that cooperation is about supporting, you know, small farmers to produce food that helps people live healthy lives. It's about looking at health systems, not of course supporting big pharmaceutical, but looking at health systems that actually touches people. If we really want to build peace, it's not about arming and rearming as much as possible people and excluding the majority of population. We need different relationships between our countries and the U.S., and it will be part of it needs to come through people to people. I am here traveling in the U.S., just came from Selma, Alabama, that has been tornado struck. But for 30 years, there's been connection between regular people in West Africa and people in the U.S., mainly from the, you know, African-American communities. We need to get at the bottom of this. Relationships start with respect. And, you know, the world has been functioning on white supremacy, valuing white life, valuing people's life, and also valuing the fact that accumulation and profit is, the call of the day, is what needs to be done. And we need to change that.
Kumba Touré, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Chair of the Board for Trust Africa, Ambassador for Africans Rising, a writer and activist based in Senegal here in the United States. Stephanie Savelle is a co-director of the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. She's an anthropologist who's researched U.S. militarism in West Africa and beyond, just back from Niger. Next up, we look at the situation in Ethiopia, 4 months after the peace deal was signed to end 2 years of war in Tigray, and just after Secretary of State Blinken has left there. Stay with us.
Welcome straight through the room, straight through the hole in the ceiling. Take your place in the sky. Thank you. just like he dreamed, just like he dreamed. Oh, your shoulders are clear. They have given up the weights and the knots.
Walk Up by Meklit Darrow. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we continue to look at U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's trip to Africa, we turn to Ethiopia. On Wednesday, Blinken met with the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and other top officials, including leaders from the northern Tigray region. Blinken praised the four-month-old peace deal that ended 2 years of fighting between government troops and forces in Tigray. He called for accountability for war crimes committed without casting blame on either side.
The conflict was absolutely devastating. Hundreds of thousands killed. Widespread sexual violence against women. Millions forced to flee their homes. Many left in need of food, shelter, medicine. Hospitals, schools, businesses shelled, destroyed. The cessation of hostilities agreement is a major achievement and step forward. Saving lives, changing lives.
During his trip, Blinken announced $331 million in new U.S. humanitarian assistance for Ethiopia. To talk more about Blinken's trip there, we're joined by Tzedala Lema. She is a journalist and the founder of At a Standard, an English-language monthly news magazine based in Ethiopia. She's joining us, though, from Germany. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tzedala. It's great to have you with us. Talk about the significance of this trip and what's actually happening in Ethiopia and in the Tigray region. How is this deal holding up?
Thank you, Amy. Good morning, and thanks for having me again. It's an important trip by the Secretary of State because the U.S. is one of the major brokers of the peace deal that was signed in November between the Tigrayan officials and the federal government. And the agreement, the peace agreement, is not really going according to what was stated in the documents that were signed in Pretoria and in Nairobi after that. So it's very important that the Secretary made this trip to push for the implementation, the full implementation of this agreement, because the implementation is lacking behind. We're not seeing so much has changed, but not enough is on the ground. So it's important for him to make that visit.
Dali, could you explain what were the terms of the agreement that you say are not being met?
The terms of the agreement, most importantly, are the establishment, the normalization of relations between the Tigray state and the federal government, and the establishment of an interim government in Tigray regional state, which is really lacking behind because the federal government, although it's not stated in the peace agreement, is holding the disbursement of the budget for the regional state until after Tigray formed its interim government, dismantled the previous government that was elected shortly before the war erupted, and established an interim government. So the federal government is still holding the budget for the regional state. Civil servants are not being paid as we speak. It's been more than 2 years. So this is lacking behind, and they need to put a lot of pressure on this, to put it on fast track. Other implementation of the peace agreement, the full restoration of services in the region, telecommunication and banking, although it has been restored, the level is not by any chance close to what is needed on the ground. Humanitarian access is also not that fully being implemented currently. So it's very important that the peace agreement is fully complied by both parties.
Dali, you mentioned that the U.S. was one of the main brokers of this agreement. Who were the other parties involved, and how can the agreement be implemented?
The other parties involved are the African Union itself, and the African Union has, through the support of the U.S. government, established a monitoring and verification mechanism. But we have not had any report from this office so far about the implementation of the peace agreement. We have seen initially the disarmament of heavy weaponry by the Tigrayan forces, and they have handed that over to the federal government. But foreign forces still remain on the soil of Tigray. In fact, Eritrean forces continued to be implicated in atrocities and rape against Tigrayan civilians. Amhara forces still continue occupying western Tigray and southern part of Tigray. So this report that from the verification and mechanism has not surfaced so far yet. So it's being the other parties are the African Union itself. So there is a need for this verification and mechanism office to follow through what is being implemented and what is not being followed through by the parties, particularly the federal government, which has the responsibility of evacuating foreign forces from the sovereign land of Tigray.
I wanted to talk about the issue of genocide, Sadala Lema. In late 2021, Blinken said the U.S. would decide whether the crimes committed in northern Ethiopia constitute genocide. The State Department, according to a recent piece in Foreign Policy, the State Department drafted a declaration in 2021 that the Ethiopian government's atrocities in Tigray constituted genocide, according to three U.S. officials familiar with the matter, but it never released that declaration. Your response?
Yes, I think some of my colleagues on the ground yesterday tried to ask this question to the Secretary of State, and I think his response was very vague in that regard. Yes, this report, you know, Secretary Blinken, let's first get back to it. He was the first highest-level U.S. official to admit that an ethnic cleansing did take place in the early days of the war in western Tigray. And this report now that we are learning the designation as a genocide is shelved. I think, you know, the U.S. is trying to leverage diplomacy over the issue of human rights. I don't think the U.S. will come forth to publish this report because designating what happened in Tigray as genocide requires you to follow through. And the U.S. currently is more focused in securing the Ethiopian government side or Ethiopia as a partner, as opposed to, you know, competing powers from the Middle East and, you know, Russia and China. So the U.S. is in that competition of winning Ethiopia as it is, you know, traditional ally and a bulwark of stability previously in the Horn of Africa. The region is experiencing quite a lot of competition from these competing powers. And the U.S. Wanted really to have the prime minister on its side, so I don't think they will be releasing this report, although it's somewhere in the shelf sitting there.
Dali, before we conclude, if you could just give us a quick background on the war, what led to this situation and this the commission of this, effectively, what has been called a genocide?
The war started in November 2020. Previously, in September 2020, Tigray, as a federated member of the Ethiopian federal government, went ahead in holding a unilateral election for regional council members. And after that, the relationship between Tigrayan officials, led by the TPLF, the party that's governing Tigray today, and the federal government was going down the hill. You know, they were having their sore relations previously already after the coming of the prime minister. But that election was a watershed moment that really put the final nail on the coffin for the outbreak of this war in November, shortly 2 months after Tigray held this election. So that is really at the heart of the contest between the two. And the war, the outbreak of the war was also aided and abetted by Eritrea next door, because Eritrea has historically been against, you know, the Tigrayan, the TPLF, which was a dominating political figure in the past, previously before the prime minister came to power. So Eritrea had a score to settle with Tigray. Abiy Ahmed, as a prime minister, was unhappy that Tigrayans went ahead and held their election for local council. This was not flying well in his anticipation of centralizing power. So the two came together and the war broke out in November. After that, what took place is for the history books. Very tragic unfolding, to the point that now we have a report that designated what took place in Tigray as genocide, but we may not be able to see it officially soon.
Sadal Alema, we want to thank you so much for being with us, a journalist, founder of the Addis Standard, an English-language monthly news magazine based in Ethiopia. Next up, we begin our coverage of the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Stay with us. The Iraqi musician Seita Hagopian. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. 20 years ago today, peace protests rocked the globe, held across the world, urging the United States to halt its imminent plans to invade Iraq. There were over 6,000 candlelight vigils held March 16, 2003, as part of a day of action called by the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa and others. 3 days later, U.S. President George W. Bush announced the invasion of Iraq had begun. He spoke on the night of March 19, 2003, in Washington, D.C. It was already March 20th in Iraq.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
President Bush justified the invasion on the false claim that Iraq's formerly U.S.-backed dictator, Saddam Hussein, was secretly amassing WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. Over the coming days in Democracy Now!, we'll look back at how the U.S. invasion devastated Iraq, caused upheaval around the globe. Today, we're joined by Najah Alali. She's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at Brown University, where she's a professor of anthropology and Middle East studies. She's also the author of several award-winning books on the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, including What Kind of Liberation? Women and the Occupation of Iraq. Professor Alali, welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Alali. You're joining us from Providence, where you're a professor at Brown. You've been looking at this and your own history for years. Talk about what we should understand 20 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq.
Well, the invasion had a devastating impact on Iraqi society. I mean, myself have been trying to document the gap between the rhetoric of liberation and bringing human rights, democracy, and particularly in relation to women's rights to Iraq, and the reality of what happened in the aftermath, with putting it against the historical background of 13 years of the most comprehensive sanctions that a country ever experienced. I think that's really important, that when we think about the devastation and destruction of Iraqi society, it actually doesn't start in 2003. It started with the sanctions regime on the 2nd of August, 1990. But yeah, to my mind, really the biggest losers in the post-invasion scenario have been women. I mean, the very same people that actually President Bush used them as a symbol of the midwives of the new Iraq, as he used to say. And while it is true that, you know, women have initially, in the aftermath, there was some hope. There was quite a bit of mobilization, a mushrooming of women's rights organizations. What we have seen systematically since 2003 is an erosion of the kinds of rights and the access to resources, to healthcare, to education, to labor force that women actually had during the Ba'ath regime. And I'm in no business of justifying the atrocities that Saddam Hussein committed during the 35 years of Ba'ath. But the fact is that the 2003 invasion led to greater gender-based inequality, towards a shift towards greater social conservatism. It led to lawlessness, chaos, a destroyed infrastructure, healthcare is in shambles, education is struggling. And so everyday life has become really, really hard, not only for the thousands and thousands of Iraqis who have been displaced internally or have become refugees in neighboring countries or come to Europe or to the US, but, you know, people who stayed behind. And so for me, you know, the story of the past 20 years is a story of destruction, devastation, corruption, incompetence, but also a story of resilience. I mean, you know, Iraqis are not just passive victims. And when I think about the 20 years, I'm not just thinking about the US and the UK and their responsibility. I'm also thinking about corrupt Iraqi politicians, sectarian militia leaders, and criminal gangs who have been terrorizing the country. And while they have been facilitated by the invasion, they also have to take responsibility. So it's a very complex picture. But I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that there's a new generation of Iraqis who's really trying to turn things around. We have seen large-scale protest movements over the past few years. So there is some hope, but it's what we've seen really is a tragedy that has been unfolding, and that was definitely not necessary. And although I don't think that there is a good invasion, I think that in addition to the invasion, the U.S. did everything wrong that it could have done in the aftermath of the invasion.
So, Professor Ali, could you elaborate on that? What did the U.S. do after the invasion that was wrong?
Well, I mean, most notably the disbanding of the military, and all of a sudden we have, you know, million plus young men on the street without jobs, with arms, that contributed to the creation of militia and, you know, lots of grievances within this element of population. The other thing is to go into Iraq and think of it in sectarian terms. So the coalitional provisional authority that was established by the U.S. was all based on so many Sunnis, so many Shias, so many Christians, so many Kurds, instead of thinking about the country in terms of political terms. So that actually reified and contributed to the sectarian divisions in Iraq. Aside from the fact that women's rights were the first things that dropped off the agenda. I mean, you have in the aftermath of the invasion, when there was an explosion of lawlessness and chaos and gender-based violence, you have had U.S. Military personnel who were approached by Iraqi women's rights activists and who were told, well, we don't do women. So, you know, despite all this rhetoric of, yes, we are contributing to the liberation of women, the opposite took place. The U.S. administration, the military, and also the coalitional provisional authorities turned a blind eye when we saw the mushrooming of gender-based violence. And then also de-Ba'athification, although, of course, it was very important, the process of coming to term with the past 35 years of a brutal dictatorship. But the way that de-Ba'athification actually ended up working was that it really alienated a large percentage of the population, and it contributed again to the sectarian divisions. And we know, of course, that ISIS is one side effect of the invasion and the occupation.
Professor Ali, you mentioned, to look at the context in which this invasion took place. It came after 11 years of these brutal sanctions against Iraq, more than 11 years. I think it was 13 years. 13 years of sanctions. And just prior to that, Iraq having emerged from an eight-year war with Iran.
Correct.
So if you could talk about both those things.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think, you know, we really need to think more carefully about the 35 years, because in the 70s, actually, Iraq was, despite being a dictatorship, it was flourishing economically. You know, there was the push for women to enter the labor force, education. There was a welfare state. Things started to get worse during the 80s, as you mentioned, from 1980 to 88, the war with Iran. During this period, everyone between, every man between the ages of 15 and 65 had to go to the front. Women during this period became superwomen, because Saddam Hussein at some point came out in 85 and said every good Iraqi woman should have 5 children. At the same time, well, women were under pressure to produce the future soldiers of Iraq. They were, you would find them in all kinds of jobs. So when I was visiting Iraq during that time, I saw women working at petrol stations, driving trucks. And so, you know, women filled up many of the jobs that were previously held by men. So not a good situation, but a situation where women did play an active role. And then from, after following the invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, we had the onset of sanctions, and although the idea was, the justification was to contain Saddam, it actually had the opposite effect. Saddam controlled the limited resources. It's during this time that we saw this incredible shift in terms of increased poverty. We saw the feminization of poverty. We saw that all the welfare services that the state provided, like free childcare, free transportation to work, a robust healthcare system, a robust education system, all this eroded during this period. And I remember my aunt telling me during this time, she said, you know, the first Gulf War, 1991, following the invasion of Kuwait, bridges were destroyed, but sanctions destroyed our society, and, you know, you cannot recover from that.
Professor Alali, if you could end, we just have a minute, with your, what you want to leave people with on this 20th anniversary of the war.
Well, I think that for people in the U.S., this is high time to, you know, rethink U.S. military interventions in the world. But it's also time to think about responsibility, accountability, and possible reparations. But I also want to end on the note that, as I said, the young generation of Iraqis are trying to go beyond, live beyond the impact of the invasion occupation. There's lots of creativity, resourcefulness, and positive energy. So I have some hope, but I think for people, especially in this country, you know, it's high time to really rethink U.S. military involvement and also policy more broadly, not just in Iraq, but in the Middle East and the world generally.
Najah Alali is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at Brown University, where she's professor of anthropology and Middle East studies. Her books include What Kind of Liberation? Women and the Occupation of Iraq. In fact, there are still 2,500 U.S. troops in Iraq. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Elkofte, Marie Astrid, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 21st to the 25th. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring genre-defying indie alternative artist Barty Strange as guest curator, garage rock chameleons Osays, Chicago-based indie rock three-piece Dead, Latin folk innovator Helada Negro, Toronto's viral hip-hop sensation Akintoye, gothic folk artist Emma Ruth Rundle, alternative R&B hip-hop artist Amindi, and plus many more. There's 150 artists yet to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.